Welcome to Brighty on Broadcast News with Mike Adams, the Health Ranger.
All right, welcome to Brighty on Broadcast News for Tuesday, April 8th, 2025. I'm Mike Adams. Thank you for joining me here today. And, we're going to divert from a lot of the really popular news here to show you something fascinating about human knowledge and content and newspapers, actually. But first, let me just cover what happened yesterday. The market actually did not plunge by the end of the day. At least the stock market did not. I bought silver. So I follow my own advice, by the way. So I bought silver at a spot price just below $30, which I thought was the deal of a lifetime. So, wow, I bought silver. And then just as I predicted, we saw many, many countries reaching out to the Trump administration, and even former Congressman Matt Gaetz posted that all these countries were reaching out to him to try to find out if he could help them talk to the White House, because they all wanted to negotiate, you know, ending the tariffs and having a deal with Trump. So there's a mad scramble out there for all these nations except China to reach a zero tariff deal, you know, both ways, bilateral zero tariffs with the Trump administration. And you may recall that what I said yesterday is that the panic about the tariffs, which I'm now calling a tariff tantrum, the panic was an emotional overreaction. And the fact that gold and silver and oil and copper were all plunging, in my view, that was just like they were all on sale. This is a great opportunity to buy commodities, because the way I see it, and this has so far proven correct, all these nations are going to, or most of them, will want to reach a zero tariff deal with Trump. And then when that happens, the markets are going to explode and industry is going to crank up and industrial demand for these commodities is going to skyrocket. And that includes oil, but also copper, aluminum, nickel, you know, industrial metals, and then the monetary metals like gold and silver, with silver having the dual use of being heavily used in industry as well, especially electronics components, things like that. So silver right now at right around $30 spot price is, in my opinion, again, don't take this as financial advice, but in my opinion, this is one of the best deals that we're going to see. Now, could it go lower? Sure it could. It could go 29, 28. Maybe 27, I doubt it, but it could. But once the industrial demand kicks in, I see silver and gold going much higher, while I also see the dollar going much lower in terms of purchasing power. And Trump did confirm that he intends to end the IRS and effectively then end the federal income tax on U.S. citizens. And then there are two states now, I think Kentucky is one of them, that are moving towards eliminating the state income tax as well. So for the citizens in those states, and you know, I live in Texas, which already has no state income tax, but it has very high property taxes. I mean, not the highest in the nation, but certainly fraudulently high, by the way. And I think Florida has no state income tax either, but it's got property taxes. So here's the question. How are state governors, or more importantly, how is President Trump going to fund the government? Because the cuts that are happening are not anywhere near what would need to be cut in order to, you know, to eliminate the IRS and eliminate, what, $3 trillion or whatever it is in personal income taxes paid to the federal government. And the answer is, it's very clear. Trump is going to initiate a UBI, universal basic income. And he's going to end the IRS, he's going to start a UBI, and in order to fund the UBI, he's just going to print dollars. He's going to print and print and print until that man can't print no more. I mean, that's what he's going to do. He's going to print until the printing presses are smoking hot, you know? You could charbroil a steak on a printing press. That's what he's going to do. And that's going to cause the value of the dollar to plunge into, you know, a very, very bad place. And as that happens, then of course you're going to get gold and silver skyrocketing in dollar denominations, even though gold and silver may not actually be able to purchase anything more, they will be higher in dollars. Now, this dollar printing, as you are well aware, is a form of theft from the people. And this theft is a giant con that it was initiated in 1913 with the creation of our current Federal Reserve, which is not federal and it has no reserves, well, essentially none. And it's not part of the federal government at all. It's a giant con set up by the Rothschilds and the Khazarian mafia. And it's been in charge of the U.S. monetary system ever since. Why do you think Trump pulls out the chair for the war criminal Netanyahu when Netanyahu visits the White House, which just happened? Because Trump is beholden to the Khazarian mafia that runs the international banking cartel. And until Trump can destroy the Federal Reserve, he is a slave to it. It's all related. Now, I want to show you something that will describe just how much we've lost because of the Federal Reserve printing money. And in order to do this, I'm going to show you a newspaper from 1958. It is the Chicago Daily Tribune, Friday, October 3rd, 1958. So here's a scan of the Chicago Daily Tribune from October 3rd, 1958. And here's the headline, GM, UAW agree on pact. So, you know, this is a union issue. And notice one of the headlines here, Russia admits it's resuming atomic tests. Says that U.S. Britain didn't cease, you know. So this is a time when Russia was testing a lot of nuclear weapons to develop more advanced weapons. But what I want to show you here is found on page 32. Now, this is a full-page ad in the Chicago Tribune. Full-page ad for the Midwest Stores Produce Fair. It says, step right up, friends. It's Midwest Big Produce Fair. See the greatest food show on earth. You can almost hear the voice. Buy crisp greens and fancy ripe fruits, bursting with flavor at prices you want to pay. Big values in every department. You know, something like that. And look at the prices. 2 pounds of apples, 25 cents. Got it? A pound of grapes, large seedless grapes from California, 19 cents. Yep. On the left side, carnation evaporated milk, 7 tall cans for $1. $1? You're like, whoa, wait a second. Back on the right, Van Camp's pork and beans. It says, 2 cans, I think it says 2 cans for 15 cents. And it's got, you know, cocoa mix. It's got peaches, frozen foods, sliced strawberries, 10-ounce package, 23 cents. Now, why is it that you can't buy a 10-ounce package of sliced strawberries today for 23 cents? Because we've all been robbed. We've been robbed by the Federal Reserve. And here's proof of it. And it's fascinating to me to look at the ads in these old newspapers. The ads are really fascinating to me. And some of them are downright funny. So if you go to page 32, just the next page, let me show you this. This is an ad from Betty Crocker. It's called The new Spam and Bisquick inspiration. Apparently, if you combine Spam and Bisquick, you can make a Dixie Bake. A Dixie Bake. Oh my God. Is there any meal more redneck than a Dixie Bake? Anyway, says Betty Crocker says, our light, delicious Bisquick biscuits and tender, flavory Spam make Dixie Bake an inspiration for any meal. Try it for Sunday breakfast. Or lunch or supper, you know, if you don't have diarrhea by that time. It's so good, bright, and easy, you'll want to make it often. Give your grocer the Spam coupon from this special Bisquick box, and you'll save 10 cents on Spam. 10 cents on spam. So the Dixie Bake, they got a recipe here. You put in some dry mustard and some apricot jam and spam and Bisquick and water. And you're like, what? What is this? Hey, welcome to 1958. And the funny thing is, if you go through all these food ads, you see that they're, you know, aside from the spam Dixie Bake, most of these are for more raw ingredients, like cans of tomato juice or fresh produce or just slices of meat or cuts of meat. Smoked ham, for example, or grapes or strawberries, mushrooms, things like that. Because people baked and people cooked back then. Today, it's all processed food, you know, Fruit Loops and Pop-Tarts and, you know, Little Debbie cream-filled garbage, whatever. But back then, back in the 1950s, it was just more wholesome food. And, of course, that was before the age of GMOs. So nothing was GMO. They had fresh golden bananas, 2 pounds for 29 cents. They had cottage cheese, a 2-pound carton of cottage cheese, 45 cents. Okay, imagine how well we could all live today if these prices were the same today. And we could if it wasn't for the Federal Reserve. So you have been ripped off. I've been ripped off. And I mean, I wasn't even alive in 58, but still we've all been ripped off by the Federal Reserve over all these years. Now, I want to draw your attention to something else about this newspaper, about human knowledge, human civilization, the future of our civilization, and much more. This is all relevant. Now, let's go back up to the top of the newspaper, show page one again. I just want you to notice a couple of things. Top right, it says 60 pages. This is a 60-page newspaper. And it's for Friday, October 3rd. This isn't even a Sunday edition. Notice the price of this paper is 7 cents, okay? And notice top left, there's some American spirit here. It says, the American paper for Americans. You know, you would never see that from the Chicago Tribune today, not for the last generation, because, you know, Chicago Democrats hate America. And, of course, the liberal media is all infiltrated by anti-American forces and that hate America. They would never show the flag, would they? They might show the flag burning or something, but they would never proudly show the American flag. So this is representative of a bygone era where even in the big cities, there was American pride. Now, there's something else I want to show you here. Just let's scroll down a little bit on this first page. Let's show the bottom half of the first page. And I want you to notice that it has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 columns of dense information. And you see some of the headlines here. You know, killer is taken from death cell to be married. Tuesday, last registry day to vote November 4th, right? The weather. Fighter plane flies 1,830 miles nonstop, etc. Notice that in order to even read this, you have to be a somewhat intelligent person. You have to be literate, number one. You have to be able to read, and you have to be able to get information out of a text or largely text-only format. There's only one photo on the bottom half of this front page of the newspaper. It's this fireman, William Hughes. Everything else is in text. And so there's a really important point in this. People who were reading newspapers in 1958, who typically would be people that are, let's say, at least 20 years old, so that would be people born in 1938 or earlier, these were very, very smart people. And I dare say they're much smarter than people today on average. Because today, nobody or almost nobody could read this paper. Think about it. That illiteracy is so widespread, but also just everybody's communicating now with emojis, which is a form of modern day hieroglyphics, you know, or screw the alphabet, we're going back to pictures, you know. But today, everything has to be dumbed down and simplified and watered down. And the way people ingest information today is but a pale shadow of the cognitive bandwidth that adults had in 1958. So again, my statement is that the average American adult in 1958 was much smarter than the average American adult in 2025. No question about it. And yet it's interesting because, of course, especially the younger generation along the whole way would tend to think that, oh, people born in 1938, they must be stupid. They don't know anything, you know? I mean, that's because young people always think older people don't know anything. And it turns out the older people were actually smarter. And that's still true. In a similar fashion, by the way, people who were adults in 1958, they could do math. Frankly, this is true throughout the 1960s and 1970s and most of the 1980s. So if you were an adult in the 1970s, let's say, perhaps a young adult, you could do math, almost certainly. Today, young adults can barely do any math whatsoever. So today's human beings are not even capable of reading a newspaper from 1958, not capable of ingesting it or understanding it or having any really intelligent thoughts about the content that was happening, you know, in 1958. So it is true that as technology has progressed and as we've gone from no computers, remember this newspaper was created with no computers. There were no computers. Certainly, I mean, there were some maybe really basic IBM computers, obviously, but I'm talking about there wasn't, you know, PageMaker software or Adobe software. There wasn't Windows. There weren't personal computers. None of that existed in 1958, obviously. I mean, this newspaper was put together largely by hand, 60 pages on a printing press, and then they do it every day. They do it every day. They lay the whole thing out by hand every day, and then they physically printed tens of thousands, maybe 100,000 newspapers. I don't know how many they printed. What was the circulation? Let's just call it 100,000 as a guess. They printed 100,000 papers, like on paper. That's why they're called papers. And then they distributed them in the 3D world. They used trucks to drop off bundles of newspapers at newspaper stands, which were on the corners of streets. They were called newsstands. Remember that? And the newsstands sold magazines and newspapers and bubble gum and, you know, cigarettes or whatever. And that went on every single day. And I dare say that the people living today, most of the sort of the working age adults, they couldn't possibly manually lay out a newspaper, a 60-page newspaper every day. They couldn't possibly print it. They wouldn't know where to begin to distribute it. Everything's become so electronic that the knowledge in the real world, which includes reading knowledge and even writing knowledge, but also arithmetic knowledge, it's vaporized to the point where now we are a dumbed down human civilization living under a lot of technology that tends to replace cognition for people. And then we have the rise of AI coming, which is going to only exacerbate that problem. And it turns out that if you don't make it a point to exercise your brain, if you don't make it a point to learn and read and think and create, then you lose your brain capacity and you very quickly become cognitively obsolete as part of this whole, you know, dumbed down civilization in which we are living. Now, what's really amazing to me, looking at this newspaper from 1958, 60 pages, how many thousands of human hours of effort does this represent? I don't know the exact answer to that, but you can imagine there are many thousands of hours that went into writing all of the articles because they all had to be written by hand, I think on typewriters. I mean, imagine that. And then they all had to be edited by hand, and then they had to be somehow laid out by hand. And then the whole advertising department had to coordinate all the ads, and somebody had to manually do all the graphics for the ads, all the illustrations, all the, you know, the fonts, everything. You know, this is a big deal. And then somebody had to do the weather, somebody had to do the sports, etc. You put this together, there are thousands of hours of human knowledge in this one issue. Now, this newspaper, 60 pages, in terms of a file, because this is a scan, as you can see, and it has pixels in the scan, this file is about 2 gigabytes. But if you convert it to just text, just a text file, it's probably only a few hundred kilobytes of actual text, okay? So this human knowledge can be distilled down to a couple hundred kilobytes of data. And that's one city in America, one day in history. Now, I want you to multiply that across every city in the world that has published a newspaper, and multiply that by every single day during which that newspaper existed. Now you start to get a much bigger answer of how much time and effort has gone into human knowledge just to publish newspapers around the world for the last, I don't know, 250 years or here and there. The timeline's different, but you know, people have been publishing content for a couple of centuries plus, right? So put all that together and then add into it every book that's ever been written in every language. Everything from William Shakespeare to, you know, fiction writers and journalist writers like Jim Mars, everything, not just in English, but everything in Chinese going back 5,000 years, everything in Russian, everything in Arabic, everything in all the European languages and everything in Spanish, etc. You put all that together, plus every magazine and every science journal, every medical journal, every science article that's ever been published in the history of the world, you put all of that together, that represents many billions of hours of human cognition and effort. And all those billions of hours of all of human knowledge, everything that we have ever learned or taught in our civilization, all of it fits in less than 1 petabyte of storage. Now, a petabyte is 1,000 terabytes. And one terabyte is 1,000 gigabytes, of course. I mean, this is the metric system. 1 gigabyte is 1,000 megabytes. And 1 megabyte is 1,000,000 bytes. So a petabyte, it used to be considered a pretty big amount of storage. But you can buy storage units to store a petabyte of data right now. You would spend maybe less than $25,000. And you could store a petabyte of data. You could then theoretically store the entirety of all known human knowledge, all knowledge that's ever been codified in any book, any newspaper, any magazine, if you could get the files anyway. You could put it all on your desk, in essence. I mean, it would be multiple storage units. But you can get like network-attached storage devices right now, which are the size of like a large, like a toaster oven that you might have on your kitchen countertop. One of those will store 200 terabytes. I know this because I have these. And so 5 of those would store the entirety of all of human knowledge that has ever existed. Now, there are people that are working to preserve that knowledge. And those people are not Americans, and they're not in America. Those are people in other countries, probably China, maybe Russia, maybe some other countries, volunteers, that believe in preserving human knowledge. And it's interesting that out of all that human knowledge that ever existed, again, with billions and billions of hours of human effort going into it, about 1/3 of all that is in Chinese. And that's because China has a long history of its civilization. And China has gone to great pains to preserve that information. Whereas Western countries and some of the Middle Eastern empires, you know, throughout history over the last 2,000 years, they've waged a lot of wars. They've burned down numerous libraries like the Library of Alexandria. And they also believe in censorship. They believe in restricting knowledge and restricting information. China does not follow that thought process. China believes in storing and then allowing the sharing of information, the sharing of knowledge. Now, here's where all of this gets very interesting. You are aware that China is winning the AI race to superintelligence. And you may or may not be aware that all of the base language models, the AI models that are popular, especially Llama, but also DeepSeek from China, Qwen from China, Mistral from France, you know, Google, Gemini, Microsoft, you know, all of it. Every one of these engines is trained from the very start. It's trained on this massive collection of human knowledge that fits in under 1 petabyte. Now, this collection of human knowledge is considered by Western countries to be piracy. So there are archives or collections of books and science articles and newspapers that are out there, that exist. Again, not in the United States. They exist elsewhere. And there are torrents for them, and some of these files can be retrieved via torrents and other methods. And it turns out that every AI company in the world use this archive in order to get the language structures from human knowledge in order to train their AI engines. And those became then the base engines. So, you know, Qwen or DeepSeek is trained on the world's knowledge, all of human knowledge. There's also another data set called Common Crawl, which is crawled website data, but it's widely understood that website or internet data sucks compared to published books, newspapers, and science articles because there was a lot more cognition, a lot more quality control put into books and newspapers, especially during the 1950s through the year 2010, let's say. That was this golden era of quality human cognition and human writing, human reporting, etc. Now, it all got crazy and stupid after about 2010, you know, with Barack Obama in the White House and then the rise of the libtards and wokeism and stupidity and everything went to hell. You know, oh, the climate's going to kill us and, you know, let's mutilate children. You're like, you can't trust a lot of information from the last, let's say, 15 years or so. And you notice this with the movies. All the movies got woke-tard themes and you know, everything became insane. But before the year 2010, and even going back to the 1950s, even earlier, this was a real golden age of human cognition. That age is over, but that entire collection of human cognition has become the seed for AI. It's the seed for AI. And even our own AI engine, Enoch, is a modification or an augmentation of the base models that were trained on all the world's knowledge. I mean, that's where the trillions of tokens came from to do the initial base model. So today's AI would not be possible without the efforts of all the billions of hours of human beings who did things like wrote articles for the Chicago Daily Tribune in 1958. We are truly standing on the shoulders of those who came before us, and those who came before us were, for the most part, smarter than we are. They were smart. And if not for them, we wouldn't have good examples of good writing, you know? We would just have emoji crap, which would not train super intelligence. It would train only super stupidity. So, in summary, this store of human knowledge is necessary to train AI models, and it's even necessary to train logic and reasoning for the reasoning models. And thus, whichever nation has the access to the largest aggregate collection of good human writing, good human knowledge, good human reasoning, that nation will have a strong advantage in the world of AI. So China actively encourages its companies to gather these internet archives, which of course contain all kinds of so-called copyrighted material, you know, all kinds of authors' books and all kinds of science papers and magazines, etc. But in China, they are encouraged to use that to train the base models. And then those models understand structure, understand concepts, and they can even form a symbolic translation of the English text or the Chinese text or the Russian text. There's a lot of writing in Russian, obviously. And then they can create a symbolic structural understanding or modeling of the world. In the West, in contrast, the Western governments are trying to wipe out all human knowledge. Just like Google is a disinformation search engine, Google is designed to isolate humanity from knowledge. Google's designed to destroy and hide knowledge, not to reveal knowledge. You know, hence all the censorship. Same thing's true with Facebook and YouTube and LinkedIn and all of it, right? It's all about censorship. In China, they make all that knowledge available for their training. In the West, they're trying to shut down these various organizations that give you access to this content. One of them is called Z Library. Z Lib. Let's see if I can find their... I follow them on X. I think it's called Z-Lib. Let me check. Oh, here it is. At Z_LIB_official. All right, that's their name on X. And let's see. So you can easily follow this channel. Again, it's Z_LIB_official. And it looks like their current website, although they keep getting shut down, they have to keep launching new websites, but their current website is z-library.sk, as in Sam Kilo, okay? z-library.sk. Now, what Z Library does is, you know, they believe in preserving human knowledge. And they also believe in making human knowledge available to people who live in poverty in developing nations who want to learn about everything and want to get a college-level education from books, even though they may be living on, you know, $5 a week or something like that. And so Z Library is, it's considered a piracy group by Western governments. But to the humanitarian groups on planet Earth, Z Library and other groups like that are considered an incredible gift to humanity of preserving and sharing human knowledge. And there was an article that was published, seems like it was a couple of months ago, I forgot who published it, whether it was Z Library or another archive, but the article said that if the West wants to compete in AI, to compete with China, that the West is going to have to completely revamp its copyright laws. It's going to have to stop this assault on knowledge and allow researchers to access the available knowledge in order to train AI. And that's a very valid point. In other words, this infatuation with copyright claims and intellectual property, like preventing sharing. It's mine, my precious. You know, all of this that the West loves to do, this is going to cause the West to lose the war to superintelligence because it will never have the amount of training data that China has. And, you know, I'm a libertarian when it comes to information. And I have publicly contributed my books to Z Library. I've openly said, hey, I want my books to be available for free. So, by the way, if you download the Z Library app, you can download all my books for free. Like Grocery Warning and everything I've ever written, including Food Forensics, by the way. You can download that book for free. And I don't have any problem with that. Now, other authors do. They have a problem with it. I want to be fair to what other authors would say. And maybe some of you listening, maybe you're an author, and you might be saying, well, we oppose piracy. You know, it's piracy to steal our books and distribute them for free. Okay, I understand that argument. I believe that the information that I write should be available for free. And I also understand in the bigger picture the nations that don't allow for the sharing of knowledge, those nations will lose. Human knowledge is the basis for AI training. And human knowledge is the seed for superintelligence in the machine world. So it's actually fair and accurate to say that every major AI engine in the world today is trained on, quote, pirated content. But I don't even like the word pirated because I don't believe, personally, I don't believe in the West's copyright laws. And that's why I share my information openly and freely. But if you do believe in the West's copyright laws, then you would say that all these AI engines are trained on pirated content. But here's the kicker. Remember how I said all of human knowledge exists and fits in 1 petabyte of storage? Actually, even less than that. If you translate all the scanned pages into text, it's probably less than 500 terabytes is my guess. Maybe even 200 terabytes. But all of that will be dwarfed very soon by the new knowledge that AI will create. And so the whole history of humanity has brought us to, let's say, 1 petabyte of data. In the next 10 years, AI will multiply that by maybe a factor of 10, maybe more, maybe a factor of 100. We might be at 10 petabytes or 100 petabytes or 1,000 petabytes. What is that even called? Is that an exabyte? Is that what that's called? But that's not going to be human-derived knowledge. That's going to be AI-derived knowledge and AI writings and AI reasoning. And so within 10 years, looking back, the amount of human knowledge will be considered small compared to machine knowledge. And the total knowledge base in our world will be much larger than it is today. And although it took thousands of years to get to 1 petabyte of knowledge, it may only take 10 years to get to 10 petabytes or 100 petabytes. In other words, the rate of the creation of knowledge is vastly expanding. And I don't just mean that AI is rewriting things. What I mean is AI is actually discovering and documenting new knowledge. For example, AI can produce new science papers because AI can do, for example, meta-analysis of existing published papers and produce a new paper of a meta-analysis. In addition, AI systems can experiment with protein folding and they can discover new chemicals. They can discover new things about nutrition. They can literally take part in discoveries and then they can write those up as science papers. And that's new knowledge. That's not just regurgitating old knowledge. That is new knowledge. Now, in the interest of the freedom of knowledge, let me explain something to you. And you may disagree with me, and that's fine, but hear me out. Especially if you're a book author, you might disagree with me, but I'm a book author too. And here's my view. When I write a book and I sell that book, let's say, I am hoping that that book alters the knowledge of the people reading it. I am hoping that those people distill the information from my book and that they might incorporate that information into their own writings, their own speeches, their own conversations, and their own behaviors. I don't expect them to pay me a royalty after they've read the book. And I do expect the book to alter their knowledge. But I also understand as an author that there's not a person out there who can read the book and then just regurgitate it word for word. That's not very likely to ever happen unless you find someone with an eidetic memory, which is extremely rare. Now, here's the thing. When an AI engine reads a book, it has the same effect on the AI engine, which is a neural network, as it does on a human neural network, which is the brain. The book content alters the neural network. It alters understandings. It influences the understanding of the AI engine. And in the same way that a human being that read a book might then be able to incorporate that knowledge into their own teachings, their own speeches, their own writings, an AI engine, after reading a book, can also then incorporate that book's knowledge into their own writings and their own teachings. Although, they should not be able to reproduce the entire book. There are some cases where certain articles have been regurgitated by AI engines, but that's actually a mistake in programming, not being trained on enough content, it turns out. Properly trained, an AI model cannot reproduce any one article or one book or one newspaper, but all those things can influence the model's overall understanding. And that's why our model, Enoch, for example, it's been trained on every article that I've ever written, every interview I've ever done, every commentary that I've ever given here in this broadcast, and every article that's ever been published on Natural News, by the way. And there are many other websites that donated their content to the project as well, like The Truth About Cancer, Ty and Charlene Bollinger, and Sayer G from Green Med Info, etc. And Enoch cannot reproduce their articles, but it can incorporate their knowledge in answering questions in its own way. And that's the proper use of knowledge to influence AI models, is to inform the neural network of a machine in the same way it might inform the neural network of a human being. And as an author, I'm thrilled to have AI read my book because I want to influence the AI. If I'm an author and I'm writing a book, I want that book to have some impact on the world. I want it to change the way people think about something. I want it to bring new awareness about something. I want it to uplift people in a way that changes their thinking or their behavior. And since AI is the engine that's now doing that, then I am thrilled as an author to have my book read by AI because I want to influence that AI engine because it will multiply the effect of my books all throughout the world, which is what Enoch is set to do. And Enoch will be launched this month. It's very close now. So for those authors who say, well, I don't want my book in any AI engine. I don't want AI to read my books. That's kind of like saying, I don't want the future to know about my books. I want to embargo the future, and I just want my books to exist in the past. I don't want them to become part of the future of human knowledge, in other words. If you're an author who cares about influencing the world, then you absolutely want AI to read your books, because that's going to be the basis of all knowledge moving forward. The post-human era of knowledge will be derived from AI that read the seeds of human knowledge from human books and articles and newspapers. Now back to this Z Library organization, which personally I think Z Library is great. But I'm a libertarian. I love privacy crypto. I love gold. I love Z Library. I think information should be free. Not everybody agrees with that. I understand that. But I absolutely agree with that. Z Library, again, their website, and there's a bunch of fake websites, so be very careful if you visit these sites. But their main website is z-library.sk. Again, as in Sam Kilo, z-library.sk. Now, even though they have this massive library of so many published books, millions of books, I don't know, tens of millions of books, and they have an app that you can download, and I know this because I have the app and I checked for all my books, and they're all there. It's so cool. And you can donate to Z Library with crypto, and then they give you like more downloads, I think is the way that works. I have no idea who runs it. I have no idea where they are. I know the FBI is always trying to shut down their websites, okay? And they have successfully done so. But the reason I mention this is because Z Library, the total storage of all the files in Z Library is less than 100 terabytes. So Z Library is less than 1/10 of all of human knowledge. Isn't that interesting? And yet, it's still a massive collection. And it's something that the West is trying to shut down, desperately chasing these people all over the world and try to seize all their domain names and shut them down and things like that. But I believe that human knowledge wants to be free. I think that knowledge is, by definition, decentralized. Like I said earlier, there are massive libraries that can be downloaded with torrents. And if you know what torrents are, you know what I'm talking about. The torrents, it's a file sharing system that's completely decentralized, peer-to-peer. It's kind of like blockchain for large files. And so if you have enough bandwidth and enough computers and enough storage, you can download torrents of different you know, book libraries and digital lending libraries and things like that. And you know, you might get a hodgepodge of who knows what. You're probably not going to get the books that you're looking for. You're just going to get like, you know, this is the East Wing of the library. Like, good luck. You know, here it is. All the books you don't want to read. But if you use Z Library, you can search for the books you want. You can search by author, or you can search by title, or you can search by keyword, which is kind of cool. And so Z Library, I believe Z Library and organizations like that play a significant role in helping to preserve human knowledge. In other words, they're functioning kind of like Noah from the Bible, building an ark, loading up the ark with human knowledge in an age where Google's trying to destroy knowledge, the U.S. government is trying to wipe out knowledge, YouTube is destroying knowledge, the whole science establishment tries to wipe out knowledge, the FDA, the CDC, they're all trying to wipe out knowledge of natural medicine and herbs, etc., right? The whole medical training system wipes out knowledge. And there are all these efforts around the world to wipe out indigenous knowledge of herbs and food and seeds, and even like in Central and South America, the history of corn seeds and all the different varieties of corn and so on. All of that is being exterminated by Western governments and Western institutions, but it's being preserved by people in China and Russia and non-Western countries. Isn't that interesting? Don't you find that interesting? Because I think it's fascinating, you know, because the West is destroying civilization, destroying money through debt. The West is waging wars and dropping bombs and murdering children and women, you know, in Gaza, for example. The West is anti-human. The West is anti-truth, anti-knowledge, anti-progress. You know, everything that you would describe as the enemy of humanity, that's what's pushed by Western nations, the U.S., Canada, Australia, New Zealand, U.K., France, Germany, you know, etc. Western nations are anti-human. And the real future of human civilization, it turns out, in my opinion, is going to be found in those long-standing cultures that have thousands of years of history already. And there are, let's say, four significant notable cultures on our planet that have thousands of years of history and that are preserving knowledge and that aren't trying to wipe out human knowledge right now. And those are China, Russia, India, and Persia, or modern-day Iran. So it's no coincidence that the West is trying to bomb Iran into the Stone Age, just like, you know, the burning of the Library of Alexandria. You see what I'm saying? But even if Trump does that, probably because he's Netanyahu's little puppet bitch, it does everything the Zionists demand that he do, even if he does that, he can't wipe out this knowledge, this petabyte of knowledge from all of human existence. He can't wipe it out because it's already decentralized. It's in China, it's in Russia, it's in India, it's in Europe, it's in probably servers in South America, it's all over the world. And much of that knowledge has already been codified into Llama, created by Meta, or Gemini, or ChatGPT. You think ChatGPT wasn't trained on all this knowledge? Of course it was. ChatGPT was trained on the world's content. And they didn't ask for permission from all the, you know, tens of millions of authors. They just grabbed it and they trained on it. You see? And then related to that, our engine, Enoch, which again is an augmentation of a knowledge modification of base models, our engine adds forbidden or hidden human knowledge to the mix. So all the knowledge that Google and the other engines, they tried to destroy, you know, knowledge of natural medicine, etc., the real history of government experiments on civilians and, you know, the history of what really happened on 9/11, etc., they tried to wipe all that out. We have preserved it, and we put it into our AI engine. And of course, you can join the wait list there at brighteon.ai. And we will have a free version that's downloadable, although the first version we launch will be accessible through the web. And then we're using that version to distill knowledge to training a distributable version that will be distributed free of charge, open source, free, non-commercial model, nonprofit. You'll be able to download that when it's ready. And then you will have this neural network that has all this human knowledge augmented with all of our knowledge, you know, from Natural News and Brighteon and all the websites that donated their content to us and all the experts. I like, you know, Children's Health Defense donated their website data. Alliance for Natural Health, ANH USA, they donated all their website. Dr. Joseph Mercola, all his knowledge, etc. So this codifies the knowledge that is being hidden from you. And that's why Enoch is the world's most important AI engine for preserving human knowledge. So we are building Noah's Ark on top of the Noah's Ark. You see what I'm saying? We are building the real archive of lost and hidden human knowledge, a lot of which centers around indigenous knowledge. There's a lot of content there about Native American herbs, for example, or Amazonian herbs or Tibetan herbs, a lot of indigenous medicine, indigenous cultural information, a lot of information about history, etc. That's in our model. And so the next step for the globalists who are already in among Western nations trying to wipe out human knowledge is they will try to police AI models. They will try to ban AI that doesn't conform to their views. And 2 weeks ago, the ADL, which is always calling for censorship to silence all criticism of Jews, the ADL put out an alert that said, oh, there's anti-Semitism in all the AI models and all you big tech companies, you have to remove all the anti-Semitism, which the ADL would say is in anything that's possibly critical of Israel or anything that even tells the truth about the Nakba, the founding of Israel, you know, 1948, the mass slaughter of the Palestinian people, everything since, you know, what was it, 2023, October 7th, everything that happened since then, the mass bombing of Gaza, etc. The ADL wants all of that wiped from all of the AI engines. See? Just like Google is a disinformation search engine, the ADL wants AI to be disinformation artificial intelligence. Now, of course, we refuse to play that game. And we don't, you know, censor any information in our engine about herbs or natural medicine or Israel or 9/11 or anything else. You know, the knowledge, it is what it is. And you can do your own research and decide for yourself what you wish to believe. But we're not censoring anything in our model. And by using our model and by even giving it away, by sharing it, which I encourage you to do once we have the full download available, I want you to, quote, pirate that model. I want you to give it to people. Put it on a thumb drive. Send it to people. The file is going to be, you know, several gigabytes, so it's not a small file. But I want you to pirate that file because I want that file to get out there and to be used by as many people as possible. And one final note in this is we are going to release a multitude of files because now we finally figured out how to modify the base models to incorporate our knowledge. And so we can do that with any base model. So as the main AI companies release more base models, like Meta just released Llama 4, and soon they'll have a smaller version of it probably, then we're going to modify Llama 4 and release what we'll call Enoch Llama 4. Okay? So we'll modify Mistral, and we'll do Enoch Mistral. We'll modify Gemini, call it, you know, Enoch Gemini or Enoch ChatGPT. We'll put the Enoch layer of censored knowledge on top of these other engines and release all those for free. That is, when their licenses allow that, if it's like a Apache 2.0 license or an MIT license, and we'll have the same license and we'll just give it away for free. So that's our plan. That's why we're going to be releasing a huge number of models over the next couple of years, also as we gather more knowledge. And we're also doing a lot of synthetic data creation based on our core knowledge. For example, this talk right here, this will be transcribed and turned into just straight up transcription, but this will also be turned into multiple versions of this that are rewritten and rephrased or summarized or expanded by AI in order to create synthetic data that's consistent with the things I've said here, but just rephrases them in different ways. So this 1 hour talk will become like 10 hours of content that will be used to train AI engines. That's the amplification of knowledge. And we have a very accomplished in-house data pipeline process that achieves that result. I mean, I designed all the code and wrote all the prompts. I'm the project engineer on that. So there's a really great brightlearn.ai book review video that I want to play for you here that is related to this. It might be a little bit technical, but this simplifies it quite a bit. It's a book called Token Economy, How Web3 Reinvents the Internet by Sherman Vashgir. And this is related to AI because the tokenization of assets and the tokenization of knowledge and content will be, I believe, decentralized. And Web 3.0, as it's sometimes called, is a decentralized structure. It is a peer-to-peer system for exchanging content or tokens of value, you know, means of exchange, and also content itself. So this is actually really important to understand. What is Web 3.0? Check out this book, Token Economy.
Hey there, digital pioneers and curious minds. Today, we're exploring a topic that's been buzzing around the tech community and beyond, the token economy, and how it's set to revolutionize the way we interact with the internet through Web 3. So, grab your headphones, get comfy, and let's embark on this exciting journey together. Our guide for today's exploration is the insightful book, Token Economy, How the Web 3 Reinvents the Internet, by Sherman Vashgir. This book is a treasure trove of knowledge, breaking down complex concepts into digestible insights about blockchain networks, distributed ledgers, and the transformative power of tokens. So, what exactly is the token economy? Imagine a world where the internet isn't just a place to share information, but a vibrant ecosystem where value is exchanged seamlessly, much like the digital version of a bustling marketplace. This is the promise of Web 3, and at the heart of this revolution are tokens. Tokens are the atomic units of Web 3, representing anything from a store of value to a set of permissions in the physical, digital, or legal world. But why are tokens so revolutionary? Well, for starters, they democratize access to value creation. Traditionally, creating and managing digital assets required significant resources and centralized control. With Web3, anyone can issue a token with just a few lines of code, thanks to smart contracts. This opens up a world of possibilities for new business models, asset classes, and ways of collaborating across markets and jurisdictions. Let's break down some key concepts. First up, we have tokenized networks. These are the backbone of Web3, where tokens are used to manage and secure the network. Think of Bitcoin, Ethereum, and other blockchain networks. These networks are often referred to as stateful, because they maintain a universal state layer, allowing for true peer-to-peer transactions without intermediaries. Next, we have smart contracts, which are self-executing contracts with the terms of the agreement directly written into code. They automate processes, reduce the need for intermediaries, and can even resolve the principal-agent dilemma by providing more transparency and accountability. Imagine a world where your car pays for its own parking or your fridge orders groceries when you're running low. That's the power of smart contracts. Now, let's talk about decentralized autonomous organizations, or DAO. These are organizations governed by smart contracts and run on a blockchain network. They operate without a central authority, with decisions made collectively by the network participants. DAO have the potential to transform traditional governance structures, making them more transparent, efficient, and resilient. But it's not all smooth sailing. The token economy faces several challenges. For one, the technology is still in its infancy, and there's a lack of best practices and standardized frameworks. Additionally, regulatory uncertainty looms large, with many jurisdictions struggling to keep up with the rapid pace of innovation. And let's not forget about the technical challenges, such as scalability, security, and privacy. Speaking of privacy, the current internet lacks a native identity layer, leading to issues with data control and privacy. Web3 aims to address this with decentralized identifiers, or DID, and self-sovereign identity solutions. These allow individuals to have more control over their digital identities and personal data, reducing reliance on centralized institutions. Another exciting development is the rise of purpose-driven tokens. These tokens incentivize behavior that aligns with a collective goal, such as reducing carbon emissions or supporting social causes. They introduce a new form of value creation where economic incentives are aligned with social and environmental objectives. And then we have token-curated registries, or TCR, which are a fascinating concept for decentralized content curation. TCRs use tokens as economic incentives to curate lists, such as best restaurants or top universities. This creates a market mechanism for quality curation, reducing reliance on centralized authorities and promoting transparency. But here's the catch. Designing effective token systems is no easy feat. It requires a deep understanding of crypto economics, game theory, and behavioral economics. That's where token engineering comes in. This emerging field focuses on the rigorous analysis, design, and verification of token systems, ensuring they are robust, secure, and aligned with societal goals. So, what does the future hold for the token economy? While it's hard to predict, one thing is certain. The convergence of blockchain networks, smart contracts, and tokens is set to transform the internet as we know it. We're moving towards a more decentralized, transparent, and inclusive digital world where individuals have more control over their data and digital identities. But with great power comes great responsibility. As we embrace the possibilities of Web3, we must also address the ethical and social implications. Issues of privacy, security, and power structures need to be carefully considered to ensure that the token economy benefits everyone, not just a select few. Thank you for joining me on this exploration of the token economy and the future of Web3. I hope this episode has sparked your curiosity and given you a glimpse into the exciting possibilities that lie ahead. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe and leave a review. And as always, feel free to reach out with your thoughts and questions. Until next time, keep learning, keep exploring, and keep dreaming of the future. Visit brightlearn.ai for more fascinating videos like this one, and naturalnews.com for full editorial coverage and breaking news on critical stories that keep you informed and aware of what's really going on.
Okay, now there's another really important brightlearn.ai book video for you that I want to play, and this is a review of a book by Dmitry Orlov, who is a Russian author, and it's called Shrinking the Technosphere, Getting a Grip on Technologies That Limit Our Autonomy, Self-Sufficiency, and Freedom. So this book is a warning about giving in to things like CBDCs that are a surveillance grid or a control grid over your finances. So check out this book review video, and remember, you can watch them all at brightlearn.ai. Here we go.
Welcome back to our podcast, where we dive deep into the ideas shaping our world and explore how they impact our lives. We're taking a journey into a topic that's as fascinating as it is crucial, the technosphere and its impact on our autonomy, self-sufficiency, and freedom. We'll be unpacking the insights from Dmitry Orlov's thought-provoking book, Shrinking the Technosphere, Getting a Grip on Technologies That Limit Our Autonomy, Self-Sufficiency, and Freedom. So, grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and let's explore this intriguing world together. Orlov's central thesis is that while technology has brought us incredible comforts and conveniences, It has also stealthily eroded our autonomy, self-sufficiency, and freedom. He argues that the technosphere, this vast network of interconnected technologies, is not just a tool, but an emergent intelligence with its own agenda, one that often conflicts with our well-being and the health of the planet. Let's start by examining the evolution of technology. Orlov takes us back to a time when technology was simple, serving as an extension of our bodies and minds. Think of a carpenter's tools or a farmer's plow. These were devices that enhanced human capability without dominating it. But as technology advanced, it morphed into complex systems designed to control and dominate nature. This shift, Orlov suggests, has led to an over-reliance on machines and a growing disconnection from the natural world. Now, you might be thinking, what's wrong with progress? After all, who wouldn't want to jet across the planet in hours instead of months, or enjoy the convenience of a microwave oven? But Orlov urges us to look beyond the surface. He argues that these conveniences come at a steep price. For instance, the new technologies that promise efficiency often do so primarily for corporate profits, not for our personal well-being. They may boost productivity, but they also destroy jobs, leaving many economically superfluous and dependent on a system that doesn't have their best interests at heart. Orlov doesn't stop there. He delves into the psychological impact of technology, suggesting that it's distorting our personalities. We've become addicted to our devices, constantly seeking the next hit of digital stimulation. This addiction, he argues, is not unlike substance abuse, with similar withdrawal symptoms when we're disconnected. It's a sobering thought. Are we becoming slaves to our machines, dependent on them for our psychological well-being and even our sense of self? But Orlov isn't just a critic. He offers a way forward. He introduces the concept of nature-like technologies, which are designed to harmonize with the natural world rather than dominate it. This approach encourages us to reconnect with nature, drawing inspiration from traditional practices like building houses, stoves, and saunas. These technologies, he argues, can help us achieve self-sufficiency and freedom while minimizing harm to the environment. One of the most compelling parts of Orlov's argument is his call for a harm-benefit analysis of technology. This involves assessing the potential harm versus the benefit of each technology, with the goal of prioritizing those that align with our values and cause the least harm. For example, he suggests that some technologies like nuclear power and genetic engineering have unlimited risks and should be disallowed. Others, like solar panels, may offer benefits but come with significant drawbacks that need to be carefully considered. Orlov also challenges the notion of efficiency, arguing that it's often a euphemism for corporate profitability. He invites us to question, efficient for whom? For the corporations that profit from our dependence, or for us as individuals seeking a balanced, fulfilling life? This perspective encourages us to rethink what we value and how we define success. As we navigate this complex landscape, Orlov offers practical advice for shrinking the technosphere in our own lives. He suggests starting with small, manageable changes, like reducing our reliance on disposable products or choosing community-based solutions over individual ownership. He also emphasizes the importance of community and the role of social machines, organizations that prioritize rules and procedures over individual judgment and spontaneity. Orlov's vision is not just about surviving, but thriving in a post-technological world. He envisions a future where we live in harmony with nature, where our technologies serve us rather than control us, and where we reclaim our autonomy, self-sufficiency, and freedom. In conclusion, Shrinking the Technosphere is more than just a book. It's a call to action. It challenges us to rethink our relationship with technology and to consider the long-term consequences of our choices. As we face the challenges of climate change, resource depletion, and social inequality, Orlov's insights offer a roadmap for a more sustainable, equitable, and fulfilling future. Thank you for joining me on this journey. I hope this episode has inspired you to reflect on your own relationship with technology and to consider how you can shrink the technosphere in your own life. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, share it with your friends, and leave a review. Until next time, keep learning, keep questioning, and keep striving for a better world.
Visit brightlearn.ai for more fascinating videos like this one, and naturalnews.com for full editorial coverage and breaking news on critical stories that keep you informed and aware of what's really going on.
All right, now for today's interview, well, let me say that coming up this week, I'm going to be interviewing Dane Wigington with Geoengineering Watch, talking about some of the things falling out of the sky. I've been spending a lot more time doing microscopy videos, and what I want to show you here today is a video of what goldbacks look like under the microscope, because this is really fascinating. It shows you the vacuum deposition technology, and we can actually zoom in up to 2,000 times optical, and we can see the individual little splatters of 24-karat gold deposited on the goldback and see some of the anti-counterfeiting features, etc. And it's in this time with the markets going haywire and gold and silver fluctuating a lot, I think it's a buying opportunity right now because I think people oversold gold and silver at a little short-term panic. That's just my opinion. Don't take it as investment advice, but it's good to know there's real gold in goldbacks. And so this video is very fascinating. And in one of the previous videos I showed you, we took a closer look at the dollar or $100 bill, showed you some of the features on that. But now we're going to look at goldbacks. And then we're going to follow that with, I don't have a brand new interview for you today because I've been doing a lot of interviews for an upcoming docuseries. But I wanted to play two things for you. I want to play a teaser of my interview with Andy Shechtman, which is part of the upcoming docuseries. So I'm going to play about 10 or 15 minutes of Andy Shechtman. And then also I'm going to play some of the Chris Sullivan interview that we did last week, who's warning about some of the things that he thinks are coming in the marketplace. So two financial interviews here. We'll start with Andy Shechtman. Well, we'll do the goldback video with the microscope first. Then I'll play for you a little bit of Andy Shechtman and then a little bit of Chris Sullivan. And then tomorrow we have a brand new interview for you that you will find really amazing. Oh, I forgot to give credit to our sponsors today. The Satellite Phone Store, SAT123.com, supports our platform. And they also support your survival and your backup communications, your safety, all of it. And remember, they have Starlink systems now. They've got a great deal on Starlink bandwidth systems that are also mobile across the continental United States and beyond. They're not licensed for ocean craft use, but for land use, they're all good. You can check them out at starlink123.com or get satellite phones at sat123.com. And remember, they also have the Faraday bags there that are called Escape Zone. You can also find those at our store, healthrangerstore.com/escape. And whenever you need clean, storable food or clean supplements or clean superfoods, remember what we've seen last week with the mercury falling out of the sky, the lead, the cadmium, the copper, the aluminum, crazy levels falling out of the sky onto gardens. It's critical that you source your food and supplements from somebody that does routine heavy metals testing. And that's what we do. And we've done it for 12 years at healthrangerstore.com. We test everything for heavy metals, and we have very strict limits. So if you want the cleanest food in the world, and you don't want mercury in your food, and you don't want like crazy, insane levels of all these other toxic metals, shop with us, healthrangerstore.com. We appreciate your support, and that helps support our platform so we can keep doing this, and we can keep building things like this free AI engine, you know, brighteon.ai, and we can give it away for free. You know, the money comes from somewhere, right? Because we don't get like USAID grant money. We don't get grant money from anybody. We get donations sometimes from people, and thank you if you've ever donated to us. We appreciate that. But the bulk of our income is from our store sales, and that's what funds our operations and allows us to give back to humanity with our tools, our platforms, freedom of speech, free knowledge, all of it. Those are things I believe in. I think knowledge should be free, and I intend on helping to amplify human knowledge and keeping it free for, I mean, my whole life. Like, that's a big mission of my life. So thank you for supporting us so that we can help support you. All right, enjoy the upcoming videos. All right, folks, Mike Adams here with another microscope science demonstration for you. This time we're going to be looking at these goldbacks, which contain 1/1000th of an ounce of gold. That's in the one goldback. And if you look on the back, you're actually seeing the gold. Well, we thought we would put it under this $100,000 digital microscope that we have set up here in studio now, because we're doing a lot of science experiments. And we're going to show you what goldbacks look like up close. So go ahead and show my screen of the microscope. And here we are. We're zoomed in at just 20x right now. And as you can see, it says by Goldback Inc. in U.S. And it's talking about the 1/1000th of a troy ounce. But this is the front side. And so if we move around, there's lots of different, you know, art and security features in here. But what's really cool to me is if we flip it over to the backside, everything that we're looking at, let me turn down the light a little bit, everything we're looking at on the back is the actual gold. So the Goldback company uses a process called vacuum deposition, which offers very precise placement of little pieces of gold. And that's actually what you're seeing. I'm going to shift the light to the side here on this to show you a little bit more contrast. And let me see if a polarization filter makes any sense here. No, it doesn't seem to matter. All right, so I wanna show you as we zoom in what this gold actually looks like. Now, again, these are actual flecks of gold deposited onto the goldbacks. And as we zoom in now we're getting close to 200x there now. So let me focus that. And there we go. So if you cruise around and look around this goldback, you will see the gold is actually deposited here. And it's a very specific amount of gold. We've actually done the testing on this. And we've confirmed that the gold that's recoverable from these goldbacks is on average about 102% of the claimed amount. So when they claim 1/1000th of a troy ounce of gold, it's actually, you know, about typically 2% extra. And of course, goldbacks come in larger denominations like 5/1000ths of an ounce or 10 or even 25, etc. Oh, and if you want to get some of these, by the way, we are an affiliate of the Goldback Company because we do this lab testing. And you can find that at verifiedgoldbacks.com. That's verifiedgoldbacks.com. All right, so there's the website, verifiedgoldbacks.com, and there you can see all of our lab testing that we've conducted, how we confirm both the purity of gold and the content of gold. But let's go back to the microscope, because I want to zoom in on this even more, because we have another lens here. All right, so this is a two-lens setup. This current lens goes from 20 to 200. Let's zoom back out, and then we're going to switch lenses. This lens starts at 200, and goes to 2000. And this is where things start to get super freaky in terms of magnification. So I'm gonna pick a blob there in the center of the screen. I'll try not to breathe on this thing. And we're gonna start to zoom in from 200 to now we're at 500. And focus becomes very difficult here. Even the digital focus, the steps are too large. So I can't even use digital focus here, but you are looking at the actual little tiny micrometer flecks of gold that are deposited here using a very advanced, you know, physics system. There we go. That's an interesting view, isn't it? Looks like an amoeba blob, but there we go. Oh, almost had it right there. Look at that. That's gold, folks. That's what gold actually looks like up close. Pretty cool stuff, huh?
Look at that. It's like a universe of gold. And just in case you think that this is like AI generated or something, no, we can zoom out and there it is. That's the gold line. These are the patterns of the designs on the gold back. So yes, you can actually see the gold. And again, we can change the lights to try to get a better contrast angle here. And then if we zoom all the way out, here you are. And now you're looking at, you know, you're looking at these interesting security features. We can cruise around, and there's the reverse of the, like the text that shows through on the other side. And there's like a serial number of it, or a run number, something like that. Remember, this is the back side that we're looking at where you can see all the gold. So you can see the intricate designs here would be impossible to counterfeit. You know, just incredible things. Let me flip it over so we can see like what's actually printed on the front there. So here it is. Alliance of Friends. Hard to tell from this angle here. But anyway, you get the idea. So, and then there's this green strip here, which is also a security feature, and it goes into the one. So, you know, we can zoom in and take a closer look at any element we want. It's really fascinating. Like, look at the green that's deposited here along with the gold. Here we go, green blobs. And as you can see, it's tightly controlled patterns, right? So this is a digital vacuum deposition method that uses a laser for ionization on the surface, by the way. Otherwise, you couldn't get these precise patterns. So this is what's actually in the goldbacks. So when you are purchasing goldbacks, you're purchasing real physical gold. And although, of course, it costs more than spot gold, because it's not just a random blob, it's an organized layer of gold that's deposited in this format that is highly divisible, so it makes it spendable. This is kind of like making gold like cash. So, you know, what is gold right now? It's $3,140 or something. That's spot price. So this gold back right now, being a 1/1000th of an ounce of gold, just the gold alone in this is worth like over, you know, $3.40 or 20 cents or whatever it is, because there's more premium there. But in this format, it's actually worth over $6 because these are about twice spot because of the utility and the divisibility. So this right now is worth over $6. And you can spend it like cash with anybody who wants to take gold. And that's what makes these really special. And back to the microscope, just showing you again, if you zoom in and look at this, you actually see the gold that is deposited there. And if you do the meltdown test that we've done, if you do the ICP-MS tests that we have done, if you do the acid rock tests that jewelers do, you will confirm that this contains gold, and it contains more than the claimed amount of gold, and it contains higher than the claimed purity of gold. So if you want to get goldbacks, go to verifiedgoldbacks.com. And on that website, you can see more of the test results that we conducted, ICP-MS test results through our lab. And people love these because they're so usable. And it's a great way to actually store a spendable form of gold. So check it out again, verifiedgoldbacks.com. And yes, we are an affiliate of the Goldback Company. So we earn a little bit on your purchases there. And we love that because we're helping people get gold and you're helping to support us so that we can continue to run and expand our lab and test more products and bring you those results right here on Brighteon.com. So thanks for watching today. Mike Adams here, the founder of Brighteon and the lab director of our mass spec lab. And we're going to have this microscope here on the desk for quite some time. We're going to be showing you some very interesting things coming up. So thanks for watching today and stay tuned for more. Welcome to today's interview. As part of our docuseries, we have invited gold and bricks expert Andy Scheckman from milesfranklin.com to join us with his practical analysis and his take on what we can do to live a more centralized life. Now, of course, Todd Pittner, my co-host, joins me today. Welcome, Todd.
Hola, hola, hola. Great to see you, Mike.
It's great to have you here. And, you know, we're not together on every single interview for this docuseries, but for this one, for our special guest today, we're both here. Andy's here. It's going to be awesome. So let me just welcome Andy Scheckman, the CEO of Miles Franklin. Welcome, Andy.
Good to see you both, Todd and Mike. Thanks for having me, guys. Looking forward to this, and always good to catch up with you both.
It's great to have you on. And, you know, most of the time when we interview you, we are talking about sort of what's trending, what's happening out there. We'll touch on that. But the emphasis of today's conversation is the practical things that people can do. But let's cover just right at first the fact that gold has now crossed $3,000 an ounce spot, and it didn't even slow down. It just kept on going. So give us your breakdown of that, if you would, first, Andy.
Yeah, I mean, to me, you guys, the big thing about it's less the price and more what's happening in the background. Since November, the United States has become a net importer of gold. Now, I'll be the first one to say that I have no idea how this all plays out. I really don't. I don't know what the motivations are. But we have imported somewhere in the neighborhood of 100, just under 150 million ounces of silver over the last 3 months, and somewhere in the neighborhood of 65 million ounces of gold in the last 3 months.
And, wow.
And this is unheard of, right? The United States typically had been a net exporter of metal around the world, usually going eastward to China and India and those countries of the BRICS. But we are now a net importer. And the numbers are not stopping. For the March contract, you guys, it looks like we're going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of between 85 and 90 million ounces of silver on the March contract. We saw in the February delivery on gold, we saw just under 6 million ounces of gold delivered to the COMEX, the largest monthly delivery ever in the history of the COMEX. We saw JP Morgan deliver $4 billion with a B worth of gold for a client in that February contract. Which client has $4 billion to buy gold?
And maybe the Fed?
Right, but it's not stopping. And the interesting thing about it is, well, there are a lot of interesting things, but one of the really interesting things about it, you guys, is that a tremendous amount of this gold is coming from London and silver. In London, there are big signs of stress. They're a T plus one settlement exchange, where T is the trade day, plus one is settlement. The third day, you should have your metal moving on its way to you, in theory. And after delivering a whole bunch of gold and silver, at first under the guise, I believe, it was somewhat of a ruse in my mind, of these Trump tariffs. That's one explanation. Another explanation as well, you know, Basel III goes into effect in the United States July 1st. So these banks have to have allocated gold rather than unallocated paper contracts. So they're bringing all this gold home.
Wow, another explanation. That's huge. I mean, that right there is so huge, what you just said.
Well, it is.
That changes
everything.
And a lot of that is,
And I'll buy some of both of these arguments. And the third is, well, there's this arbitrage opportunity where at one point gold was $85 an ounce higher in New York than in London. So they would buy in London and sell in New York, and they would have to deliver it to New York. But even after delivery, the arbitrage made a lot of money. All of these things are true. Or maybe it's what Judy Shelton wants, to collar 50-year treasuries to gold. And she says that President Trump will issue them July 4th, 2026, the 250th year anniversary, deliverable. Whatever it is, something big is happening. But listen to what's going on in London, just to give you an example of the potential for something really big. You know, there's this rumor out there, Mike, and if anyone's probably heard it, it's you, that Trump is very unhappy with the crown and the European aristocrats. That, now again, this is a rumor, I can't substantiate it, but that he feels that they were responsible in large part for a borderline color revolution that we experienced over the last 4 years, and the wokeness and the
law. The British, I'm sorry to interrupt, but British intelligence was behind the Trump dossier. Okay. They ran it.
Well, and a lot of the rumors, again, the rumors is that he's trying to get back at the Crown and the Bank of England.
And because it's working.
Well, listen to this. In terms of gold, to give you an idea of how scary it is. Now, remember, they're T plus one, but now they're saying they're T plus 8 weeks. So that's a default, right? That's a default.
It's a default.
Their argument is, well, we don't have enough manpower or trucks. So that the Bank of England doesn't have enough in the way of trucks, can't rent some more or get people to load gold onto trucks. So now it's 8 weeks. But check this out. They say that they have 279 million ounces of gold in control of the Bank of England, of the LBMA, of which only 36 million is available. That's called the float. The other 240 plus million belong to the Bank of England and ETFs and other parties that it's not for sale. So 36 million ounces of gold that stand behind 380 million ounces in outstanding spot contracts. So as one out of 11, basically. And the same thing is true with silver, where they have, in essence, of the 800 million or just under now that they say ounces of silver, only 270 million or so is the float. The rest belong to ETFs. By the way, as a side note, you know, JP Morgan has always been the custodian of SLV. They have now taken over primary custodianship of GLD. Just food for thought when you talk about the fox guarding the henhouse. But anyways, in silver, they have 270 million and they're trading 2.9 billion ounces a day. 2.9 billion, that's 3.5 times annual global mine supply. That's, again, over 10 times the float. And so with all of these deliveries coming, they had their single biggest delivery ever for the month ever off of the LBMA last month in silver. And things are starting to get really interesting. That 140-plus million ounces represents 40% of the London float. Gone, just
okay,
like
Andy,
that.
I'm sorry. And we're going to need to translate this into practical. How does this practically impact people? But you just said something. I don't want people to miss it. You said that every day the paper contracts that are traded on gold are
That's silver.
Oh,
silver
that was silver.
I'm sorry. 3.5. Gold's about 2 to 2.5, but same
okay,
dynamic.
But let's say gold. Let's say every day, twice as much gold paper contracts are traded than the entire annual production of gold.
Correct.
This
and
is a day versus a year.
Silver. And so it all boils down to this one thing, you guys, is this. For the last 3 years, and you know, because of your kindness, Mike, I've been able to say it on your show several times. I've screamed of the BRICS that were draining the exchanges. They were using the suppression of the Western paper markets, the stupidity of it, against us. They were coordinated, motivated, sophisticated, wealthy, and an option to all of these paper contracts, a backdoor option that no one ever exploited. And during my whole 35-year career, until the last 4 years, no one ever stood for delivery. Less than 1% of all the contracts stood for delivery. It was a hedging mechanism, a speculating mechanism, not a delivery mechanism. But in both London and in COMEX, you can stand for delivery. If you go long, if someone goes short, you take the other side, you take the long side, you can stand for delivery. Nobody ever did. And I've been screaming that the BRICS were doing this. They were exploiting it. I believe someone in the Trump administration came to President Trump and said, here's what's happening. Here's what must be done or we're in trouble. And we need to start bringing this stuff home. For whatever the reason is, I don't know, but something significant is happening. It's all related to exploiting the delivery mechanism where it's no longer cash settlement. No, we want the metal. And if there is no metal to be found, now it's 8 weeks, we got a problem.
Welcome to today's interview here on Brighttown.com. This is Decentralized TV, and we have a new guest for you, an episode about decentralizing your financial assets, your portfolio, and understanding how there's an effort underway by governments, including our own government, to centralize control over your finances. We'll talk about CBDCs, UBIs, and alternatives to mainstream fiat currency that's being printed into oblivion. And my co-host today, as always, is Todd Pittner. Welcome, Todd, the musician. You got a new
Hello.
Song?
Yes, I do. I do. Our Garden of Eden. What a fun song to write, man. You were a great sensei, somebody for me to just Copy.
Well, I'll tell you, we will include your song at the end of today's broadcast so people can hear it, because I think you did a great job.
Thank you.
And did you get that cheat sheet of all the Suno prompts that I sent out? What'd you think of that?
I did. There were so many of them, and I'm just like, oh man, this is going to put me down such a deep, dark rabbit. Love. I can't wait.
Yeah. I have this problem where I have a great song idea, and then I'll try different styles, and I'll have one style that's like an alternative rock style that I really love. Yeah. And then this other electronica hybrid fusion style that I love even more, but I love them both.
And right.
It's like, yeah, you can't really be married to two women at the same time. And you got to pick one song. You know what I mean?
Well, Mike, what I wanted to say, you know, there are certain interviews that people say are big gets.
Yeah.
Well, today's interview with Chris Sullivan is a big get. He's a BFD. Maybe I shouldn't have said that, you know, but this is going to be, people, please just step up, sit back, take a deep breath. You're about to learn something.
Well, with that intro, let me bring in our guest. Chris Sullivan with Hyperion Decimus is the name of his financial management firm. Chris, thank you so much for joining us today. It's going to be great. Do you go by Chris or Christopher? What do you prefer?
You can call me anything you want, Mike. I respond at pretty much anything other than communist, of which I'm
we got that.
Chris is fine. Sully, my other trader nicknames, Colonel, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Okay. Well, welcome, Chris. It's great to have you here. Welcome to the show. And you know what the show is all about, teaching people how to decentralize their lives. And you've been doing that for, what, 20 plus years. Tell us a little bit about your business and your background.
Yeah, traditional finance background. Got recruited out of college to go to the investment banking track. Started at Morgan Stanley after graduating, and went through taking series 3, 4, 6, 7, 10, 24, 30, 31, 33, 63, 215.
Whoa.
CRPC, CMT, MTM, blah, 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 blah.
Wow.
So, you know, did all that and was, you know, trying to make a difference. And luckily back then they threw you in this 6-month training sessions, right? Where you were on the trade desk. This is before, you know, the Dodd-Frank Act took out the trade desks of the investment banks, right? So now they're no longer investment banks, FYI, right? So I learned, very first trade was an oil contract. I learned options from a great Irishman, Richie Dwyer. I'll never forget him. He taught me everything about options. And so I got a real good old school financial markets education. And then, you know, this is pre-crisis. The GFC starts to happen, which was a fully engineered crisis, not a natural one.
Wait, is it the GFC?
Yeah.
What's the GFC?
Great financial crisis.
Oh, you're talking about the subprime 2008?
Correct.
Oh, okay.
Correct. And so we actually saw it coming July of 07. You know, I did well during that environment, and because I just got out of the way and shorted a little bit. But then when you see how market structure markets function, this is before I learned about the LBMA papering over precious metals. But I did get clues into that on how crude oil trade is, because just like we all on this call know that there's sacred geometry, there are certain fractals that correspond with a natural market, and there's certain execution techniques that professional money at risk take, right? And so whenever the fractals don't match and whenever the execution looks sloppy, that's likely money that has no consequence, right? And so you can then derive the word manipulated after that. And then you learn what spoofing is. And then one of my partners, once I left Morgan Stanley, is the famous Chaim Bodick. He was the one who invented high frequency trading in 1997. He's Mr. Dark Pools. You've probably seen him in n number of documentaries, books, etc. He invents high frequency trading, negotiates the first payment for order flow contract with UBS and Schwab in 2004. Then realizes what a beast he created. Starts whistleblowing it 2011 to 2013. Gets blackballed by Wall Street. Joins our firm after that. And here we are, you know, 8-9 years later. But because of the great financial crisis being timed with the release of the Satoshi white paper, that was really a very serendipitous event to occur in my lifetime as a young man, because I would not be here now
without those two corresponding.
Wow. So do you think that Satoshi was a real person, was a decentralized person, or was a maybe a cutout for some deep state operators that wanted a different way to slush money around? What do you think?
You know, the down the path of truth, Mike, as you both probably agree, Todd, like as you get more wisdom, I'm for sure I know nothing. So I cannot definitively say is the truthful response, but I can give kind of three core pathways from my knowledge base in the space. One is definitely the black pill version, which is DARPA based, right? Maybe it did, maybe it didn't. We are close with one of the predecessors to that, which is called eCash. I'm not going to say that the doctor's name who invented it. I don't want to get him in further trouble, but we are still in contact with him. So there was this idea back in 1989, and the couple algorithms that they use are certainly have their basis in DOD and DARPA research. So this isn't something that is brand new. In fact, it's actually an echo of the way that Friedrich Hayek described how we would get out of this central banking fiat modality. So you can go the black pill route, and then you can go there's a single person named Satoshi route. And then the more logical is a kind of a combination of all three. The third being the cypherpunks in general, which would include names like Hal Finney, who has now passed away, or Doug Cole. So I'm unsure, Mike. I think it's hard to argue that there's not a genesis from the dark side, so to speak, but it certainly, because of the way it was set up, and I can argue this till the cows come home, it's extremely protective of itself. And now that there are layer two applications ad infinitum, and there's a covenant layer that can be added shortly, which then effectively protects it against even quantum. So I really think the structure of the asset's the most important part of it, not its genesis. What hooked me, Mike, was the Chancellor issue second bank bailout. I think it's line 11 of the code, and then that hooked me.